If this is your first time with us, also, we want you to know that most Sunday mornings when you attend here, we are teaching our way through whole books of the Bible, and we're currently teaching our way through the Gospel of John. The sermon series is entitled Believe, and John is showing us very clearly in his Gospel that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that by believing in him, you might have life in his name. Several years ago, I was trying to get back from a conference I had attended in Nashville, Tennessee, and there were terrible storms, and everything was backed up. Planes were getting in late and taking off late, and so I was stranded in the Atlanta airport for about 5 hours. I didn't get home till about 4:30 in the morning. But God was working in those delays because I had been praying that God would give me some opportunities to be involved in harvesting. And if you were here 2 weeks ago, we talked about harvesting. I was praying for opportunities to sow some seed or to reap or both. And I was also praying, God, if you will draw people to yourself and to me, then I will tell them about Jesus. And so I'm sitting there, and I got into a conversation with a woman, and the conversation turned towards spiritual things. And she explained to me that she was somewhere between an atheist and an agnostic. She said, I'm not an atheist, I'm not an agnostic, I'm somewhere in between. And I said, well, I know what an atheist is, and I know what an agnostic is. I don't know what's in between. And she said, well, I don't believe in a God out there, but I believe in a God in here. I believe God lives inside of all of us. So I asked her, well, but if God lives inside of all of us, then how do you explain all the evil in the world? Well, she didn't have an answer to that question, but she turned it around to explain why she couldn't believe in God as a supreme being out there. I mean, she said she couldn't believe in a God who would see all the suffering and pain and violence in the world and not put a stop to it. And so we talked for over an hour, and I shared with her how God created us to be beings with a will to choose to love him or not. And I explained how the first of us chose to go our own way instead of God's way, so that what we see in the world today, the mess we see in the world today, is really our fault because of the choices that we've made. I explained to her how our rejection of God is what caused the violence and the suffering and the pain, and how we're responsible for all of that, and how God just won't step in and change the things that we've decided in rebellion against him. And it was a good discussion. She was very bright. She had obviously thought through her belief system. And to make a long story short, this was a time of sowing and not reaping. I mean, seeds were planted, but she just couldn't get past this hang-up about God and all the suffering in the world. She wouldn't believe in God. She wouldn't believe that Jesus was God in the flesh, which we also talked about. And she basically said, I just can't accept a God like that. I need more. And really, everybody has that same problem to some extent. I mean, we have a hard time letting go of what we're trusting in, especially if it means believing in a God we can't understand. We find it hard to let go of what makes sense to us to believe in a God that we can't explain. Now, how many of you know what I'm talking about? That it's hard to believe sometimes in a God that it just doesn't make sense. I mean, if you've been walking with God any length of time, you have no doubt found that God doesn't do things the way that you think that he should. I mean, people die earlier than expected. And some suffer lengthy illnesses, while others seem they experience miraculous healings. And the world is full of suffering and violence and evil that God could prevent if he so desired. And even God's own people, the church, is so splintered and divided when we should be unified. I mean, one thing is for sure, you can't put God in a box and think you have him all figured out. And that's a real hindrance to faith. It can be a real hindrance to faith. And in this passage from John's Gospel, we see Jesus acting in some unusual, unorthodox, unpredictable ways, in ways that to us don't make a lot of sense. However, what we're going to see in this passage is that he always acts consistent with his heavenly Father's sovereign purposes. And if we look carefully, I believe we can find at least a partial answer to the question, the big question, why does God do what he does the way he does? Why does God do what he does the way he does? This is just a partial answer. That's a bigger question than I think that our minds can comprehend. But John chapter 5, beginning in verse 1. This morning, I'm just going to walk through the passage, and I'm going to make comments and observations along the way. Chapter 5, verse 1. After these things, there was a feast of the Jews, and Jesus went up to Jerusalem. The question is, after what things? Well, if you've been with us for the last several weeks, and if you've been reading in John's gospel, you know that it was after the Samaritan woman at the well came to believe that Jesus is the promised Messiah, that story. After many, many Samaritans in the town of Sychar believed that Jesus came to believe that Jesus is a savior of the world. After the nobleman and his entire family came to believe in Jesus, after Jesus healed his son. After all of these very, very positive things, Jesus returns once again to Jerusalem for one of the feasts. Now, only John's gospel includes Jesus going back and forth to Jerusalem for several of the feasts. Matthew, Mark, Luke, they only focus on Jesus' final trip to Jerusalem. So Jesus comes again to another feast to worship with God's people in accordance with Jewish law. And evidently, John doesn't tell us what feast it was, but it's not germane to John's purposes to tell us which feast. But his point, John's point, is more about that after all of these positive things happen, we begin a section of John's gospel that focuses on the rejection and the open hostility that Jesus will experience from the religious leaders. And so what we're going to see here is how the hostility intensifies, how what has been festering since Jesus ran all of the sacrifice salesmen out of the temple on his first visit to Jerusalem. Now it becomes so heated that the religious leaders begin plotting his death. And there's no doubt in my mind, and this is what I want you to see this morning, there's no doubt in my mind that Jesus does what he does right here in order to tick off the religious leaders. Okay? Now for this, verse 2. Now, there is in Jerusalem by the sheep gate a pool, which in Aramaic is called Bethesda, which has five roofed colonnades. By the way, the pool is about the size of a football field, and it was 20 feet deep. So here are a couple of pictures. This is what the pool would have looked like, the colonnade with the steps going down. And let's go to the next picture. And this is what it looks like today, which you can see if you go with me and my friend Charlie Dyer to the Holy Land in the spring of 2021. So we're going to see all of this. It'll be my third time going, my second time with Charlie. It's going to be a great trip. If you want to go, let me know. All right, so let's see. I'm totally off my notes here. So verse 3, in these lay a multitude of invalids, blind, lame, paralyzed. Now, verse 4, many of your Bibles doesn't have this in the text. It's in the margin, but I'm going to read it anyway. Verse 4, waiting, there's blind and lame and paralyzed. They're laying under the colonnades, waiting for the moving of the water. For an angel of the Lord went down at certain seasons into the pool and stirred the water. Whoever stepped in first after the stirring of the water was healed of whatever disease he had. So this is unusual, right? I mean, Jesus goes to the feast in Jerusalem to worship, and he ends up at a health spa. Lots of sick people gathered around this pool, sort of a magic hot tub here. But there was a popular legend that there was some kind of supernatural healing in the pool. And this kind of healing waters superstition is not uncommon. Hot Springs, Arkansas has that kind of tradition that goes back hundreds of years. Somebody came up, is there a Chick Springs around here somewhere? Okay, and does it have that kind of tradition as well? Okay, not sure. But anyway, somebody said it was. But anyway, a lot of pilgrims go to Lourdes in France because there's a story of an angel who spoke to a young nun. And the angel told her that there was healing properties in a certain spring there. And so legends like this are still around today. And I'm very convinced it's a legend and it's not fact for two reasons. The first reason is because verse 4 doesn't is not found in the oldest manuscripts, and most people think that a scribe at a later date inserted what's written in verse 4 as an explanation of the popular belief. But second, I want you to think about it. The rule of the rule for the pool was every man for himself. Now, is that the way that God would work? I mean, would God really heal somebody because that person can push and shove and bully their way into the pool first? I mean, if that was the way it was, think it would be a pathetic sight. I mean, you to see cripples crawling and hopping and rolling towards the pool, and blind people groping and clawing their way to the water's edge. I mean, just think about the chaos. And worse, it would never be the neediest person who would be healed. It would be the one with the least ailment that was strongest that would be able to get into the pool first. No, it's a very, very pathetic scene. So no, I don't think it happened that way at all. But many people in that day did believe it was possible to be healed that way. And there were all kinds of sick people there, blind, lame, paralyzed. Verse 5, one man was there who had been an invalid for 38 years. Now, it doesn't say that he's been lying at the pool every day for 38 years. It says he had been sick for 38 years, not necessarily at the pool. 38 years, though, is a long time. I mean, a while back, I got a cold, and I called it the end times. I mean, like apocalyptic suffering. I mean, a week. This guy's sick for 38 years. Verse 6, when Jesus saw him lying there, he knew that he had been there a long time, and he said to him, do you want to be healed? Now, doesn't that strike you as a bit strange? I mean, to ask a man who's been sick 38 years, do you want to be healed? Seems like a ridiculous question, but I don't think so. I don't think it's so much of a ridiculous question. I think, number one, Jesus wanted to get the guy's attention. And what better way to get a response out of a sick person than to ask them about their illness? And so he says, do you want to be healed? He gets the man's attention. And the other reason that Jesus may have asked this man, do you want to be healed, is that maybe he had lost all hope. I mean, maybe there wasn't anything else to do except to come to the pool and hope against hope. Maybe after such a long time of hoping and expecting to get well, and not getting well, he had given up trying to find a cure. I mean, it's possible. It's interesting, though, that this man, he doesn't answer Jesus' question. He doesn't say, well, of course, duh. You know, like, of course I want to get well. Yes, absolutely. Instead, he tells Jesus why he had not been healed all this time, verse 7. The sick man answered him and said, sir, I have no one to put me into the pool when the water is stirred up, but while I'm trying to get in, somebody else gets in before me. So basically, the man says, the only hope I have is for someone to help me get into the pool before someone else, but I don't have anybody that will stay with me and give me that kind of help. Hint, hint. I mean, really, that's all he knows, but that's what he's been trusting in and hoping for all those years. And interestingly enough, Jesus doesn't pay any attention to what he just said. I mean, Jesus doesn't try to talk him out of his belief in the power of the pool. Verse 8, Jesus says to him, get up, take up your bed, and walk. And at once, the man was healed, and he took up his bed and walked. So Jesus commands the man to stand up, take up his mat, and start walking. He commanded the man to do the very thing that he was unable to do. He commanded the man to do the impossible, but in Jesus' word was the power to do the impossible. Now, when it comes to miracles of healing and praying for miracles of healing, many people will say, if you have enough faith, then Jesus will heal you. You tell me, where is their faith in this passage? I mean, this man didn't have any faith. Now, how can I say that? Well, we're going to see in just a few minutes, he didn't even know who Jesus was. So how can you have faith in Jesus if you don't even know who Jesus is or what Jesus can do? As I said last week, biblical faith is not faith in faith. It's faith in the person and work of Jesus, but this man knew nothing about Jesus, not even his name. I mean, the fact is, if Jesus wants to heal somebody, he'll heal them whether they have faith or not. True, sometimes, most definitely, sometimes he calls for faith. At other times, like right here, it has nothing to do with faith. What does it have to do with? It has to do with God's purpose for that person. You can have all the faith in the world, but if it's not God's will to heal you, you won't be healed. You say, well, I think it's God's will to heal everybody. Don't you think that in the midst of that crowd of sick people, lame, blind, paralyzed, all these people that are there, Jesus could have just looked around and said, oh, y'all get up and go home. He's from the South, of course. Oh, he could have went around, he could have gone around and laid his hands on everybody. He could have cleaned out the whole colonnade. But he didn't. Why not? Evidently, it was not his will to do so. It was not in line with God's purposes at that time for those people. Now, I struggle with this too. I struggle with it too. But do you not think that God can have a purpose for someone's life bigger than what you want for that person's life? Not everybody gets healed. I've seen people healed. I've prayed for them. I've seen them healed. And I've prayed for lots of people and they didn't get healed. It's not God's will for everybody to be healed. Just ask Paul. God said to Paul, Paul, I know you've asked me about this three times, but the way I'm working in your life, my purpose in your life, is that I want my power, my strength to be manifest in your weakness. God's purpose for Paul was bigger than him having a completely healthy life. In 2 Timothy 4:20, we're told that Paul left a guy named Trophimus. He left him behind, didn't take him on a missionary journey. He left him behind sick in a city called Miletus. Now, does that mean that Paul didn't have faith or Trophimus didn't have faith? No, that's absurd. It's not God's will for everybody to be healed. Some get healed and faith plays a part in it, but here you see that sometimes, even when there is no faith, it's God's will to heal with no conditions. This man made no cry for help. He didn't grab Jesus by the hem of his garment and beg for healing. He didn't say, Son of David, have mercy on me. He didn't ask for anything from Jesus unless maybe he was hinting for Jesus to hang out with him so he could help him get in the pool before everybody else. But Jesus heals the man anyway. Why? Because it was God's purpose for that man, and Jesus did it as an act of sovereign grace. So he just walks over, picks this man out, he heals him, he speaks to him, and immediately he's healed. And the man stands up, picks up his straw mat, and he walks away. Why? Again, because he believed Jesus was Son of God? Nope, didn't know that. Because he believed Jesus was the Messiah? Nope, didn't know that. Because he believed Jesus was a great prophet? Nope, didn't know that either. Jesus simply says, get up, take up your mat, start walking, and the man was able to do something he could not do for the past 38 years. Now, here's what really amazes me. The guy gets up and starts walking, and he never looks back. He seems totally aloof to what has just happened. He seems all wrapped up in himself. Never thinks to ask, oh, by the way, who are you? Doesn't say thank you. I mean, sometimes a person who has been healed will say, Jesus, I want to follow you. Sometimes when someone's been healed, they'll say, Jesus, I believe in you. Or John will record, and that man believed in him. I mean, sometimes we'll read that the healed person falls down and worships Jesus. Not this time, not this man. This man just walks away and that's that. You know, you can be blessed beyond measure. You can be blessed beyond measure and put more emphasis on the blessing than the giver of the blessing. And this man has been healed by Jesus, but at the end of the day, he doesn't want anything to do with Jesus. I'm not left with a favorable impression of this guy. Now, look at what John says next, because this is what the whole story is about. It's like an explosion goes off. Look at the end of verse 9. Now, that day was the Sabbath day. I mean, Jesus, what are you doing healing somebody on the Sabbath? Don't you know that it's against our laws? Don't you know that breaking the Sabbath is punishable by death? Yep, Jesus knows all that. And he does it anyway. Now, a little bit of background about the Sabbath. The Sabbath was divinely instituted as a sign of the covenant between God and the people of Israel. And keeping the Sabbath, not working at all on the Sabbath, marked Israel out as a set apart, holy people for God. Moses said, keep the Sabbath day holy. Do not do any work on the Sabbath. But the rabbis built on that one command by coming up with 39 different categories of forbidden work and hundreds of detailed interpretations of the 39 categories. Things like, you could not carry a burden on the Sabbath. That's what this man was doing. You cannot carry a burden on the Sabbath, but neither could you wear false teeth, because that would be like carrying a burden in your mouth. I'm not making this up. You could not pluck a head of wheat out of the field, and neither could you pluck out a gray hair out of your head. You could eat an egg that was laid on the Sabbath as long as you killed the chicken that would do such a thing the next day. You could spit on the Sabbath. I mean, aren't you glad? What a relief that you could spit on the Sabbath. I mean, to go a whole day without spitting. Sheesh. I mean, you could spit on the Sabbath, but you had to be careful where you spit, because if your spit fell in the dirt and your sandal happened to scuff the spittled dirt, it would create a bit of mortar, and making mortar would be work. So spirituality could be determined by where you spit. But here's the point. The Sabbath represented the high point of Jewish religion, of Jewish legalism. All their phony religiosity came to a peak on the Sabbath. They twisted the meaning of the Sabbath so far out of whack that it had lost all of its meaning. They had taken the Sabbath, which was God's gift of rest for his people, and they transformed it into a prison of rules and restrictions. They took what God gave his people as a blessing, and the religious leaders turned it into a burden. So do you see what Jesus is doing here? This is all intentionally designed to provoke the religious leaders, to tick them off, to expose their hypocrisy. Now, why would Jesus want to purposely antagonize these people? Because nobody ever comes to God until they're willing to give up what they've been trusting in. Nobody comes to God until they give up what they've been trusting in. Nobody can come to God unless they confess there's no way they can save themselves. You see, Jesus is going after, and he does, he goes after whatever it is you're trusting in. The man that Jesus just healed was trusting in the only thing he knew, and that was his self-help plan of how he needed somebody to help him get in the pool before everybody else. And with the Jewish religious leaders, Jesus could not reach them until he confronted their self-righteousness. He had to punch them in the stomach of their sin, and their sin was self-righteous legalism. And they thought being right with God rested on how well they kept the rules and rituals and religious traditions. So with the man and with the religious leaders, Jesus is confronting them all by exposing what they're trusting in, and he's working to show them that they need to transfer their trust from those things to him and him alone. I know you're thinking, but Charlie, are you saying that Jesus knew that he would get a negative reaction from these guys? That's exactly what I'm saying. Absolutely, he was saying that. He was doing that. Just to make them hate him? No. But he had to confront them at the point of their need before they could receive or reject him. And that's part of what's going on. That's the first level of what's going on. Okay, back to the healed man. So the Jews said to the man who had been healed, it's the Sabbath. It's not lawful for you to take up your bed. And so here comes the man. He's walking along, and religious leaders say, whoa, what in the holy law of Moses are you doing carrying that mat? I mean, it is the Sabbath day. It's not lawful for you to carry your mat on the Sabbath. Now, you need to realize this man was not violating the law of Moses, but he was breaking one of those traditions they had added to the law. By commanding the man to pick up his mat, Jesus had violated one of those 39 categories. And really, it was like they were saying, whoa, wait a minute. According to Mishnah Shabbat 7.2, you are in serious trouble, buddy. But Mishnah Shabbat 7.2 was one of their laws, and it became as weighty as the law of God itself. They didn't care anything about the fact the man had been sick 38 years and now he's been healed. All they cared about was policing Sabbath policy. Verse 11, but he answered them. So the man says, well, it's not my fault that I'm carrying this mat around. I mean, it was the man who healed me, and he said to me, take up your bed and walk. And so they said, who is the man who said to you, take up your bed and walk? But the man didn't know who had healed him, didn't know it was Jesus, because Jesus had withdrawn from where he was before because there was a crowd in that place. So are you seeing this? The guy blames Jesus. Don't get mad at me. I mean, it's the man who made me well. He told me to do it. But here's where we see that he had no idea who Jesus was. So verse 14, after all that happened, Jesus found him in the temple. So Jesus seeks the man out a second time. Here's the man somewhere in the temple complex, and Jesus finds him again. Now, what does this tell you about God? I mean, let's face it. This is an unbelievable personal touch. And a personal touch from a man who's ratted Jesus out, and he's still far from God. But here's Jesus, God in a human body, the one who created all things, the one who left heaven and has come to earth to redeem the world, and he's interested in this one little man. Why? Because he is a personal God. He is a personal Savior, a personal Messiah. And so, yes, Jesus intentionally uses this sign on the Sabbath to get under the skin of the religious leaders, but at the same time, he stops to minister to this one man in order to awaken faith in him. Now, do you see how loving and merciful and compassionate that is compared to the religious leaders? Now, what does this mean? This means that God really does care about you. And I mean care about you personally. I mean, with all the things that God's got going on in the universe, he's never too busy, never too distracted for you. It's just so amazing. So Jesus finds him in the temple the second time, and in verse 14, Jesus says, look at you, up, walking around. Oh, my goodness. Have you ever felt so good? Wow. Now, let me just tell you, go and sin no more so that something worse doesn't happen to you. So what does he mean by that? Sin no more that nothing worse may happen to you. Well, honestly, I'm not 100% sure. But he's definitely saying that sin does have consequences. In other words, he's saying continuing in a lifestyle of sin after experiencing God's grace does bring consequences. Grace doesn't cancel consequences. Or let me say it this way. Experiencing grace doesn't mean that if you sin, there are no consequences. Grace means that God accepts you in spite of your sin, but grace doesn't mean it's okay for you to continue in willful sin. Now, what Jesus says here may imply that the man's illness was the result of sin. I mean, some sin earlier in his life, and it is true that some sickness is the result of sin. The Apostle Paul, when he's talking about the Lord's Supper in the Christians in Corinth, he says that some of them have gotten sick and some of them die because they dishonored the Lord's Supper. So, yeah, it's true that some sickness is the result of sin. The Jewish leaders believed all sickness was the result of sin. But when we get to John 9, and you really need to read John 9 in contrast to what's going on here. It's just absolutely amazing the difference between the man born blind and how Jesus heals him and his response to Jesus and this guy right here. But when we get to John 9, Jesus is going to tell us very plainly that not all sickness is the result of sin. Job's friends tried to tell him that his sickness was the result of sin, and God rebuked them for that. But here what we can say is that Jesus warns this man of even worse consequences if he doesn't let what God has done in his life bring about real life change. Jesus is saying, turn away from your sin, your sinful lifestyle, your self-help lifestyle, or something worse than sickness could happen to you. And I don't know about you, but I really wouldn't want to find out what the something worse is. So what does a man do with that? Again, silence. Nothing. He doesn't fall down and worship Jesus as some do. He doesn't profess Jesus as a Savior as some do. I mean, remember verse 1. After all of these people believe in Jesus, now here is a guy who gets unexpectedly healed, and what does he do? Verse 15, what do you make of this? The man went away and told the Jews that it was Jesus who healed him. Now, if there was something, anything positive in his response to Jesus, then maybe I would conclude that he went back to give testimony to Jesus, but all we get is crickets from him. I mean, all we get is silence. So it seems to me that he went back to rat Jesus out. I mean, he betrays the one who's shown him grace. It's the guy that healed me, you know, it's his fault that I've been breaking the Sabbath laws and traditions. His name is Jesus, and you can find him in the temple if you're looking for him. That's what I think happened. And that's when the official persecution, that's when the firestorm of official persecution begins. I tell you, this story is really not as much about the man who gets healed as it is about what Jesus intentionally started by healing the guy on the Sabbath. What John is showing us is that the healing of this man sets in motion the plot to kill Jesus, and that's what he tells us in verse 16. And this is why the Jews were persecuting Jesus, because he was doing these things on the Sabbath. But Jesus answered them and said, "My Father and I are working until now, and I am working." My Father is working until now, and I am working. Now, did you catch the phrase in verse 17? It says, "And Jesus answered them." And evidently, those religious leaders followed the now healed man back to Jesus, and when Jesus finished talking to him, "Go and sin no more," they were next in line. "What are you doing telling people that they don't have to obey our Sabbath laws?" And Jesus says, verse 17, "My Father is working until now, and I am working." And man, I'm telling you, that is some kind of statement right there. You see what he's saying? He's saying, God, my Father, and I, his Son, we don't stop working on the Sabbath. God's love, God's mercy, God's compassion, God's judgment, and all of God's holy attributes go on 24/7. And Jesus is saying, God, my Father doesn't rest on the Sabbath, and I don't rest from work either. He's saying that he has the same divine prerogatives to work on the Sabbath as God. He makes God's work and his work synonymous. Because you see, according to Jewish tradition, the 39 categories of rules and restrictions they came up with it to explain, keep the Sabbath day holy. According to their tradition, only God is exempt from the prohibition to work on the Sabbath. According to their tradition, a person is permitted to carry things on the Sabbath, but only in his own courtyard. Isaiah 6:3 says that the whole world is God's courtyard, so God can carry anything, anywhere, anytime he wants. In the same way, Jewish tradition says that a person can carry something the distance of his own height. The distance of his own height. And since God fills the heavens and the earth, Jeremiah 23:24, once again, there's no limit to God's carrying. It was their way of legitimizing their religious rules without painting God into a corner. They understood that God must carry the universe, and if he took a day off, then the whole thing would collapse. So God is on 24/7, and it is precisely these divine prerogatives, as stated in Jewish tradition, that Jesus is leveraging here. He's saying the Father continues to work on the Sabbath and I continue to work. He was claiming divine prerogatives, and that set their heads on fire. So now the religious leaders don't just accuse him of breaking the Sabbath, they accuse him of blasphemy, and blasphemy is punishable by death. So Jesus is claiming to be equal with God, and that's exactly what they understood him to be saying. Look at verse 18. This was why the Jews were seeking all the more to kill him, because not only was he breaking the Sabbath, but he was even calling God his own Father, making himself equal with God. That's what the story is all about right there. John has told us in chapter 1 that Jesus is God. And now he tells us that Jesus claims to be God. And the Jewish religious leaders hear that loud and clear, and John says that's the reason that they want to kill him. So this event right here paves the road to the cross. But what amazes me about this story is the way that Jesus does what he does. Jesus does things in the most unusual, unorthodox, and unpredictable ways. And as I thought about what actually happened in this story, here are some of my thoughts about those unusual, unorthodox, unpredictable ways. Number one, Jesus doesn't always do things the way we ask. Now, this is the second time that somebody proposes a solution to a problem, and Jesus completely ignores their solution. Last week, the nobleman asked Jesus to come to his home to heal his son because he thinks the only way Jesus can heal is if he's present. But Jesus ignores that request and heals the son outright from a distance of 18 miles away. And here the lame man thinks, hint, hint, that the only way to be healed is to have somebody help him into the pool, and Jesus heals him outright. Jesus doesn't always do things the way we ask. Second, Jesus doesn't always do things the same way. When it comes to healing, sometimes faith is required. Here, Jesus didn't require faith. Here, Jesus heals immediately. At other times, there's a progression to healing. Sometimes Jesus heals by speaking, sometimes by laying his hands on people. One time, John 9, he healed a blind man by making mud out of dirt and spit and applying it to the man's eyes. Do you know why now? This hit me like a revelation this morning when have you always wondered why Jesus made mud and put it on the man's eyes? It happened to be on the Sabbath, and he was making mortar. It was a direct attempt to provoke him. I was like in Starbucks going, ah! Like, why did Jesus do that? He doesn't do the same thing the same way with everybody. Number three, Jesus doesn't always do things the way you might expect. I mean, think about this. I mentioned it earlier, but it bears repeating. In this story, Jesus walks into the middle of a great crowd of sick people, blind, lame, paralyzed. He's the great physician. He could have waved his hand and healed everybody. He could walk into a hospital and clear the hospital, but he doesn't do it. He could have done it. I mean, but why not? Look down in verse 21. It says, "For as the Father raises the dead and gives life to them, even so the Son gives life to those whom he chooses, to those whom he wills to give it." I mean, you could just as well insert the word healing there for life. "For as the Father gives life to the dying, even so the Son heals them, those whom he chooses." He doesn't always do what you expect him to do. Number four, Jesus doesn't always do things the right way according to our definitions of how God should act, according to our definitions of right. And according to the Jewish leaders, you just didn't break their Sabbath traditions. But Jesus could care less. He didn't care about their traditions because those traditions favored rigid rules and religious correctness over mercy and compassion. He doesn't always do things according to our definitions of right and how we think God ought to act. So how does he do things? Jesus always acts like God because he is God. And as God, he does things according to his sovereign purposes and sovereign grace. Mark it down. In your life, Jesus will not always do things the way you ask him. He will not always do things the same way. He will not always do things the way you might expect. He will not always do things in what you consider to be the right way things should be done, with your religious comfort zones and your religious boxes, according to your definitions of right. He won't, but he always acts like God. That's the point. Sovereign in his purposes, gracious in all of his ways, confronting us head on with whatever we're trusting in, confronting our wrong-headed ideas about how life should work, confronting our false hopes in false messiahs, confronting whatever it is we feel comfortable with, especially when our comfort zones prevent us from knowing God as he really is and not the way that we want him to be. And on top of that, sometimes Jesus will ask you to do impossible things. Impossible from our perspective. And they feel impossible because sometimes Jesus deals with us in unusual ways. I mean, I can't get over how little he required of this sick man. The man didn't ask to be healed. He didn't have everybody in the church praying for him. The man didn't have to exercise faith. The man didn't even have to know who Jesus was, and Jesus healed him anyway. The man had a self-help mentality. If I could just get if somebody helped me be the first one in the pool, then my life would be totally different. But do you see that by not requiring anything from the man, there was no room for self-help strategies. Only Jesus could do for him what needed to be done. He couldn't help himself. That's part of the point here. Sometimes Jesus deals with us in unorthodox ways. I mean, why did Jesus push the buttons of these religious leaders? Because they had a self-righteous mentality. And the only way that they would be able to come to Jesus would see that they can't work their way into God's favor. And Jesus used unorthodox methods to try to shake them out of their self-righteous orthodoxy. He will blow your comforts, your religious comfort boxes out of the water. Sometimes Jesus deals with us in unpredictable ways. I mean, he goes to a feast in Jerusalem to worship, and he ends up at a health spa. He heals a man. He requires nothing of him and gets nothing from him except betrayal. Why? I mean, he provokes the religious leaders by telling them he's equal to God, and that sets a trajectory straight to the cross. Now, when we started reading chapter 5, when we started reading this story, would you have predicted that all the dominoes would fall so quickly from Jesus healing one sick man? Why would Jesus do things that way? It doesn't make any sense. One reason. Jesus deals with us in unusual, unorthodox, unpredictable ways in order to call us to trust in him and him alone. When God doesn't do things the way that you ask him to do them, when he doesn't do things the same way in your life as he did in somebody else's life, when he doesn't come through for you the way that you hoped or expected, when he doesn't do what you think is the right thing for God to do, when he puts an impossible situation in front of you, know this. Jesus is saying, I am God. Trust me. I am your only hope. He's saying, I am God. And the way that I'm working, I know you don't understand. In fact, I can never explain it in a way that you could understand. But trust me anyway. I am your only hope. I am your steadfast hope. I mean, what is it in your life that's got you all upside down and turned inside out? Jesus says, my Father and I and the Spirit are working in your life right now. Trust me. Steady yourself on me. Cast yourself on me, because I am with you and I am for you now and forever. Amen.